This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. Today we're in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the Desert Research Institute, home of the new Atomic Testing Museum. We're here at the invitation of Nevada Public Radio and the Las Vegas Centennial to help celebrate the 100th birthday of Las Vegas, a city that many believe was born long after 1905 in the mind of mobster Bugsy Siegel.
I have found the answer to the dreams of America. You want to be a little more specific? The flamingo.
A bird?
Look, what do people always fantasize about? Sex, romance, money, adventure. I'm building a monument to all of them.
What are you talking about here? A whorehouse?
No, I'm talking about a hotel. I'm talking about Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm talking about a place where gambling is allowed, where everything is allowed. The whole territory is wide open. I'm talking about a palace, an oasis, a city. Do you know that when the Hoover Dam is finished, electrical power is going to be available on a massive scale in Las Vegas? Everything will be air-cooled. Every room, 72 degrees at all times. The casino will put Monte Carlo to shame. We'll have wall-to-wall carpeting, we'll have Italian marble, we'll have badminton courts, stables, we'll have a lightning-fast train going from Los Angeles to Las Vegas in an hour. We'll have planes back and forth. Meyer, we'll have our own airport.
I think what Ben is saying is it's a good place to trap people in to take their money. Is that what you're getting at here, Benny?
Much more.
That's the Hollywood version of Las Vegas history, Warren Beatty as the mobster Ben Siegel in the film Bugsy. The real and lesser-known history of this city is an important part of the story of America's migration to the West. Railroads, the Depression, the construction of the Hoover Dam, water, air conditioning, World War II, and America's entry into the nuclear age. Later in the program, we'll take you on an audio tour of the Atomic Testing Museum, but first, the history of Las Vegas beyond the casinos. Many of you have visited Las Vegas. We'd like to hear today from those of you who grew up here or had family who did, the people who invented this city before it was reinvented. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. We also have an audience here in Las Vegas, and we'll be taking questions from them as well. We begin with a longtime Las Vegan, Michael Green. He's also a professor of history at Community College of Southern Nevada and the co-author of Las Vegas, A Centennial History. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Why does Las Vegas trace its origins to May 15th, 1905?
Well, on that day, we had a land auction. There was a railroad built through here, a partnership of the Union Pacific and Senator William Andrews Clark, a Montana copper baron who wanted a piece of the Southern California boom and some of the central Nevada mining boom. So they first competed, then came together, got the railroad built, and they scheduled an auction on May 15th. And one of the lines one of the newspapermen had was that it was a way to give everybody a fair shake down. Senator Clark had bought 1,800 acres of land from the woman who owned most of the valley, Helen Stewart, just 3 years before for $55,000, and in 2 days he sold just the downtown area for $265,000. So I think Mrs. Stewart thought she had a pigeon, and it turned out Clark had a lot of pigeons.
Well, there had to be a reason. I know Las Vegas is roughly halfway between San Bernardino and Salt Lake City, which were the terminuses of the railroad in question. But there was also another commodity here that was absolutely critical to the survival of the railroad and this town.
It was water. We actually had some then. Las Vegas is Spanish for the meadows, and there were the big springs that Clark had bought that as well. And that meant that he could have what he needed to do the repairs, to have a town built right there. And we used up a lot of it. The railroad controlled the town and wouldn't build water lines out beyond the original downtown area. So people who wanted to subdivide land just outside it dug wells. So at one point we had something like 100 uncapped artesian wells running around the clock. So we've learned to conserve since.
About time.
Took a while.
Yeah. Just put it up there and put some pirate ships in it.
That and the occasional volcano.
That doesn't do anything to it at all. Now, we talk about, obviously, the town starting in 1905, and you can debate when the actual start of the town was, when it was incorporated, I guess, in 1911. But clearly there were people who lived here before the railroad, before that land auction.
Well, there were Native Americans here, especially Paiutes, for, of course, a couple of thousand years. But the original settlers, if you will, of the valley were Mormons. Brigham Young sent missionaries here in 1855. They built a little fort mission. And his idea was pretty similar to why people had been coming here before and why people would come here afterward, which was a safe haven. Mormons had a history of being shot at and killed, and he wanted Mormons who were traveling from Salt Lake to San Bernardino to be able to stop off somewhere safe. He also wanted, of course, to proselytize with the Native Americans here, teach them farming techniques. So they set up a mission, and the mission came apart within a couple of years, partly over divisions over whether they were going to be mining or really out there Christianizing. Part of the problem, frankly, I had an old professor at UNLV, Ralph Roski, who used to say that the most important person in the history of Las Vegas was not Bugsy Siegel, it was Willis Carrier, because if he hadn't invented the air conditioner, we wouldn't be here. And the poor Mormons, after a couple of years, they were sunburned enough. So they left, and for the next just about half a century, it was a couple of ranching families that dominated the valley. And the 1900 census showed a population of about 30, and some of those signatures looked alike. So we're not really sure there were 30. But we had grown to 937 by 1910, and people said, wow, what growth.
Well, what was it like when this place grew up as a railroad town?
This was, in a lot of ways, a company town, the way people would think of one back in the coal mining country, for example. Workers were not paid in scrip, but the railroad certainly was the dominant employer. Everybody kind of worked on railroad time. It was a 24-hour town from the beginning because if the train was coming through, the passengers needed something to do while the train was being repaired. So a lot of people either worked for the railroad or depended on it. And, you know, most people don't think of Las Vegas as being a small community with people building churches and building schools, but basically they were trying to start a little town in the West, and they also were promoters even then. There's no evidence that anybody in 1905 said, what happens here stays here, but they were promoting the town as, of all things, a mining and agricultural center. Well, they had water, so they could logically argue for agriculture, and this is Nevada, the Silver State. So even at the beginning, they were pushing the idea that there was something special about this place, that people should come here.
Well, we want to get listeners involved in the conversation, of course. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk now with Kathy, and Kathy's calling us from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I went to school and grew up in Las Vegas and graduated in the early 80s. And I went back maybe 2 years ago, and I almost didn't recognize the place. It had changed so much from the time I grew up there until a few years ago, and I don't like it as much now as I did then. I think the character of the place has changed significantly, and it's nearly doubled in size, and I think the sense of a smaller town community is really gone.
Doubled in size, Michael Green might be putting it mildly.
Very mildly. We have just about doubled in size with every census for the past century, but now we're up to 1.7 million, and most of them are on the freeway. Listening to this, probably sitting in traffic. But, you know, there's a tendency to say, oh, the good old days were always better. And one time I was saying that in a Nevada history class, and a woman raised her hand and said, was it better for women? I woke up. That took care of that theory. One of the problems we do face, of course, is that we grow so fast we can't even keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
The projection is that we'll be to 3.5 to 4 million in another 2 decades. Well, that suggests we need to double everything we have right now. So there's supposedly more growth coming, and I do wonder what the pioneers would be saying today. They'd be saying we did our job too well.
Kathy, I heard you trying to get in there.
Well, I was saying that I don't necessarily think that it was better in all respects, especially when I grew up there. Vegas was going through one of its bust periods when a lot of the unemployment was really high, and there was pretty significant difficulties to living there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of, I suppose, you knew your neighbors better. Everybody worked in the casinos if they had a job, but it was viewed more as, well, that's just their job. You know, you still had a life outside of the typical, you know, the stereotypical glitz that people perceive Vegas as. But now it seems like even the residents of Vegas think of nothing but the glitz.
Well, we're going to be hearing more about that, Kathy. But as you hear, it's not a popular point in the audience. But thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. Boom and bust has, of course, been a cycle in Las Vegas, I guess, ever since the beginning, Michael. Let's get a call in from the audience. A question.
Yes, hi, I'm Jeff Burbank. What is the most misunderstood aspect that people have outside of Las Vegas about the town's history?
Most misunderstood, Michael. What do you think?
Oh, how many hours do we have? I think one of the most misunderstood is, in fact, the mob. And I'm not saying that there wasn't organized crime here. But one of the things that people don't understand is that Bugsy Siegel, for example, was not the rule. He was the exception. Bugsy Siegel was a thug. He killed people. Most of the guys who built this town were businessmen. They were mob businessmen, but they were still business people. And one of the gaming regulators here in the 50s used to call them silk glove men. They didn't make the hits. Maybe they ordered some, but they didn't do that. And so I think everybody tends to think that this town was built by a bunch of killers, and then in turn that all the rest of us must be mobsters too.
Instead of the Wild West shoot-off in the streets, there were cars driving by with Tommy guns rattling out the windows.
Exactly. Well, actually, they used to say nobody gets killed in Las Vegas. And so Bugsy Siegel, when he was finally the victim of a hostile takeover, and it was a very hostile takeover, he was killed in L.A. Another guy who was involved in gaming here, they wanted to get rid of, he was killed in Phoenix. They tried to keep the town clean.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about the story of Las Vegas on and off the Strip. If you've brushed up against the history of this 100-year-old city, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, the address, as always, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, live in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the auditorium at the Desert Research Institute in Las Vegas, Nevada, home of the Atomic Testing Museum. Long before neon lights and no-fault divorces, Las Vegas was just another dusty railroad town in the glaring Southwest desert. In honor of the city's 100th birthday this year, we're tracing its history from rails through atomic bombs. Several years ago, Nevada Public Radio began collecting oral memories of early Las Vegas. Here's Ed Van Tobel remembering when his father bought land in Las Vegas 100 years ago.
My dad came up here on kind of a lark. He was working in Los Angeles in 1905, and he and his buddy read the ad in the Los Angeles Times that they were opening up a new town in Las Vegas, and they were auctioning off lots, and you could take a round trip to Las Vegas and stay overnight for $23 or whatever it was. And so they thought, well, that'd be a good, nice couple of days to go up there and see what was happening. And the second day, they made an offer to sell the lots at a discount and with a small down payment. The original purchase was on South Main Street in about the 500 block. They bought two or perhaps four little 25-foot lots, or at least made the down payments on them, and that's where they started their business.
And you can hear more of the Las Vegas I Remember series by visiting the Nevada Public Radio website at knpr.org. We'd like to hear your stories of old Las Vegas as well. Our phone number, as always, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now on the panel is someone who grew up watching the Hoover Dam being built. Darryl Luce arrived in Las Vegas in 1932 at the age of three. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry to have given away to your age to those who are arithmetically capable. I know as a boy you watched the Hoover Dam going up. Tell us about that. But this was an enormous construction site.
Yeah, it certainly was. My father had a small retail business here in Las Vegas, but he had a smaller store in Boulder City. And because of this, he was allowed to go into Boulder City because they had gates on the only road out there, and you had to go through security to get into Boulder City. And so because of the store, he would go out there quite frequently. And he used to take my sister and myself with him. And the fellow that ran the store, he and his wife lived in the back of the store, and he was a security guard at the construction site. So he would tell my dad what areas were available. And so we used to go down and watch them do the work. We would see the big, huge trucks. We'd see the cableway coming across and dropping down the cement. And sometimes the men would go out on the cableway. They would go in a big, huge basket. They would take 30 or 40 men. And I've seen that going on. And the thing that was probably most unique about my experience was that they had to build cofferdams to dry up the dam construction area. And so for several years it was all dry. But when they got time to let the water start coming in, they'd been diverting the water through tunnels, diversion tunnels that had been created in the sides of the canyon. That was a tremendous project in itself. But the water had been diverted, and then it came time that the dam was ready to meet the test of having water come up against the face of the dam. So not too long, just about a week before the water got up high enough, they closed off the diversion tunnels, and then, of course, the water began to rise on the upstream side. And so my dad drove his car clear down in the bottom next to the upstream side of the dam, and my sister and I got out of the car and went over and touched the bottom of the dam, which is now roughly about 600 feet underwater.
Wow. You mentioned Boulder City. It was known originally as Boulder Dam. How did it get renamed for arguably the most unpopular president of the 20th century?
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Hoover, but I'm sure it was political.
No.
He was up for re-election, and he was not very popular, and he wanted to get his name attached to something that was being productive and furnishing jobs.
Didn't much help him in that 1932 election, did it?
No.
Let's get another question from the audience here in Las Vegas.
Hi, this is Dan McHugh, and I have a question about Hoover Dam. Which do you think was most important to the growth of Las Vegas, Hoover Dam or the basic magnesium plant that was built a few years later in Henderson?
Well, why don't we get Michael Green to help us answer that?
Oh, it is kind of a chicken or egg question. But since the dam came first, I think we have to go with the dam, just because it led to the first population spurt. The other thing that the dam did that really nobody expected was that it became a tourist attraction. Hundreds of thousands of people were coming here to look at this eighth wonder of the world, and the Boulder City area was a federal reservation, and they banned everything that tourists like to do. The workers couldn't even do it. So Las Vegas was just up the road, so they'd come here. Basic magnesium is crucial, no question. And it does build the town of Henderson, which, like Las Vegas, is one of the fastest-growing cities in the country.
Thanks very much. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Patricia. Patricia's with us from Bishop, California.
Hi there, Neil. Love your show.
Thank you so much.
I was a chorus girl there in the 50s. I worked at the Sahara when it was a one-story hotel, and they put us up in a little place we used to call the tool shed, all 12 dancers and showgirls. And we changed the show every 2 weeks. We worked 7 days a week, and it was wonderful. It was great, you know, a great job. I learned why you earn, that's what they always said. But I worked with some great stars, and there were some questionable people that ran that place, but I didn't get close to them. But it was pretty interesting. There was nothing like it is now. I go there and I get shell-shocked just looking at it. You know, it's hard to believe that these years have gone by and this huge progress that's happened. It's pretty amazing.
Well, to reiterate the question Professor Green was asking himself earlier in the program, was it good for women? Patricia, not to you, Professor.
Oh, good.
So hard, who knows? I remember one time going over to the El Dorado and getting on a horse, and they used to have El Dorado days, and I went out and bought a jacket with fringe, I bought the cowboy pants and the boots and the whole thing, yeah, you know, just to fit in, and went riding one day, and the horse took me out in the field, and then all of a sudden he turned around and went like a bat out of you know what, coming back, and that was my experience. But I mean, we used to have, we got our fun where we could get it, because we had to rehearse every day except a couple of days. And I remember one time we were coming home, and they did took the atom bomb, and everything lit up like daylight. A couple of times that happened.
Well, we're going to be talking more about that later, Patricia, but thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's talk now with, let's remember to hang up the phone, Mr. Clever. All right, let's talk now with another woman who was came out to Las Vegas in 1950s. 94-year-old Alice Key joins us now. She's a retired deputy labor commissioner for the state of Nevada, played a long-running role as a community activist in Las Vegas, including a stint as executive director of the Las Vegas branch of the NAACP in the 1970s. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You came to Vegas, as I said, in 1954. How come? To be a showgirl?
No, not at all. I had been out of show business 10 or 11 years when I came to Las Vegas. I came to Las Vegas because of Dr. Charles West, who was the first black physician in the state of Nevada. He and his wife were friends of mine, and they had visited California on a vacation. And he mentioned that Count Basie, he had run into Count Basie, and who had mentioned to him that he would like to see black professionals in Las Vegas. He played here often, and it was highly discriminatory here, mm-hmm. Las Vegas was. And nobody could stay at the hotels where they stayed. They had to come over on the west side. And he said he felt sorry for the children because there were no black professionals. They had no role models, no doctors, no lawyers, no professionals. And Dr. West laughed and said, I imagine asking me, and I'm not thinking about going and taking another exam to practice medicine in another state. But I looked at Dottie, who had dollar signs in her eyes when she asked the question, you mean no black doctors in the whole state? So on the way back from the beach to Los Angeles, she whispered to me and said, what's the capital of Nevada? And I said, I haven't the faintest notion. But we called the newspaper, and they told us Carson City was. So she called Carson City. And it so happened, I don't know how often they give it now. At that time, it was only once a year. It was only a couple of days from the date she called. 3 months later, she called me from Detroit and said, we're packing for Las Vegas. And then they were kind of lonesome for some of their personal friends when they first got here. It was quite a cultural shock from the Las Vegas was.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you're talking about this place. This was a Jim Crow state.
It was called the Mississippi of the West.
Not in a good way, I suspect.
No, but if you were black and as old as I am, everywhere was Mississippi of the West. At least... You know, I have been discriminated and segregated against in New York City and Los Angeles, California, and my home, well, the town I grew up in, Riverside, California. But there were a lot of great people here.
Mm.
There weren't a lot of people, but out of that percentage, there was a goodly number. One of them is sitting here in the audience, Thalia Dondero and her husband, Harvey, who was administrator at the school district, Edith Katz and her husband, Lloyd, and Ruthie Deskin, who we lost last year, and her husband, who was a sports writer.
Again, we think of the mobsters, we think of the great entrepreneurs. We don't think of the people who built the civic structures of this town.
Absolutely, because these were three couples that, at the NAACP, whatever they promoted, whatever they were doing, fundraising, whatever, these were the three couples that supported us heartily.
Mm.
Physically and financially. And I had the privilege of honoring the widows. All three of them were widows at the time. Well, it's been a few years ago because of their contribution to the... What really happened was that we finally got public accommodations and fair housing, and we passed a civil rights law before the 1964 civil rights law. And... a great deal of credit should go to those white people. But as a matter of fact, if there weren't for good white people in the world, we might still be in slavery.
Alice Key is with us here in the audience on the panel as we're broadcasting live from the Desert Research Institute in Las Vegas, Nevada. Our other guests include Michael Green, a professor of history at Community College of Southern Nevada, and Daryl Luce, who first came to Las Vegas in 1932 and remembers the building of the Hoover Dam. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another question from the audience here in Las Vegas.
Marie McMillan, we've all heard about the Moulin Rouge and the entertainers and the partying during that time, but were all of the showgirls and entertainers black at the Moulin Rouge?
It was a black show. Clarence Robinson, who was the, you're talking about the original Moulin Rouge.
That's
the,
right.
The first interracial hotel casino here. Clarence Robinson, who was the producer of the Cotton Club shows in New York, brought the show out, the first Moulin Rouge show out, and it was an all-black show.
Michael Green?
That, and you found a lot of white entertainers coming to the Moulin Rouge after their shows were over.
You could have shot a cannon through the casinos and hotels on the Strip, which there were about five or six at that time, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you wouldn't hit anybody because they were all over there at the Moulin Rouge watching that show and gaming.
Here's an email question we have from Peter in North Beach. When I first visited Las Vegas, I was surprised to find a large and thriving Chinatown. What's the history of Las Vegas' Chinatown, and how did Chinese immigrants arrive there? Michael?
As crazy as this is going to sound, we built the Chinatown Plaza, and then we got more immigrants. The tradition with the Chinatown, it's a story of segregation, whether it's New York or San Francisco. And there were Asian residents in the vicinity of the Chinatown Plaza, which is a couple of miles west of the Strip. But some businessmen came here in the mid-90s and built the Chinatown Plaza and had markets and restaurants and the like. And then more Asian immigrants started moving in there. So if Las Vegas has a tradition of doing things in a strange way, we managed to invent a Chinatown backwards.
And let's get another caller on the line. And if I remember to push the right button, this is Kate. Kate in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay, I wanted to tell you that the real architect of the Flamingo Hotel was my father, Richard Ryerson Stadelman, who was a very important architect in Las Vegas in that time, did the City Hall and a stadium, which I can't remember the name of, and many homes and schools and other important buildings.
And were you living in Las Vegas as a child growing up?
That's right, I was born there.
And I guess it must have probably hasn't changed a bit.
Oh, yeah. I haven't been there in many years, but it looks completely different from it was the way it was in 1948 and in the early 50s when I was there.
What was the innovation architecturally were incorporated into the Flamingo, do you think? Kate?
I'm not sure of that. I know that the movie in that regard was correct, that he continually made changes, which haunted my dad.
Michael.
Well, what made the Flamingo so different on the Strip is that the first two hotels built on the Strip were sort of the classic southwestern ranch-style low-rises, and the Flamingo was a low-rise. But Siegel and Billy Wilkerson, who was also one of the original builders, their vision was to build a kind of suburban, classy, luxury resort for the Hollywood crowd. There's some Miami Beach influence there as well. So the Flamingo isn't necessarily new to American architecture, but it was different for Las Vegas.
Different for Las Vegas. And when did the first high-rises start to go up?
The first high-rise on the Strip was the Riviera, which is celebrating its 50th birthday this year. It was built in 55. It was 9 stories, and people just couldn't believe it. Downtown, I think the first elevator was at the corner of 2nd and Fremont around 1933. So it took a while for us to Manhattanize.
Kate, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And when we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our tour of Las Vegas history and then focus on the new Atomic Testing Museum, which has just opened up in this city. Ready your goggles and your Geiger counters if you ever were part of the atomic testing program in Las Vegas, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting live from the auditorium at the Desert Research Institute in Las Vegas, Nevada. Tomorrow, of course, it's Science Friday, and Ira Flatow will be here with a discussion of sexual abuse and its cost to society. Can science help us deal with sexual abusers? That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. Today we're telling stories from 100 years of Las Vegas history with Michael Green, a history professor at the Community College of Southern Nevada. Also with us, Daryl Luce, who came to this city in 1932 at the age of three. And also with us is Alice Key, executive director of the Las Vegas chapter of the NAACP in the 1970s. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Beth. Beth's calling us from Modesto, California.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to thank you. I really love listening to your show.
Thank you.
I'm a native of Las Vegas, former native of Las Vegas, and a Chinese American. And so I grew up in Las Vegas, and I just wanted to share that my experience was one of sort of being a token, because I was always just the only Asian American in the class from elementary school all the way up to high school. I know someone wrote in an email about the Chinatown. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if Michael Green could comment, though, on there was an older part of Chinatown, or an old Chinatown in Las Vegas, around Charleston, East Charleston, Fong's Garden. I don't know if he can comment on that or not.
Michael?
Yes, there are several Chinese restaurants, markets in that part of town, and East Charleston's one of the older sections building up, in, especially in the 40s. And Fong's Garden, I believe, was Wing Fong, who went on to be involved in banking. His wife, Lily, was a university regent. And the Chinese community here traditionally was small, but some of the members of the community have been very influential in our development.
Even reading back on some of the history of Las Vegas in preparation for this program, Chinese families were amongst the earliest here after 1905, Japanese as well as African Americans, of course.
Yes, this was a mostly white town at the outset, but from the beginning, there is an ethnic mix. It's not exactly a melting pot, but it's close. And sadly, there was a lot of segregation, not just of African Americans, but of other groups. They tended to be shunted to one side of the town site, trying to keep them out of the way. But you find early on in Las Vegas, Chinese restaurants, Mexican restaurants, some markets, there's a small ethnic community here from the beginning.
And Neil?
Yes, Beth.
Could I make one more comment? My family moved to Las Vegas originally because my father worked for the test site. So kind of segueing into the atomic issue you were going to talk about, he was a scientist with the Department of Energy for many years.
You ever considered becoming a radio producer, Beth? Thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. We're going to get to the Atomic Testing Museum in just a moment. And by the way, if you have questions about that, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Let's get another question from the audience here in Las Vegas.
Oh, I'm Thalia Dondero, and my question is on the atomic bomb. But what I am a member of the Order of the Tortoise. And I've been here since 1943. So I just had to ask if you knew what it was like to be sure you were awake in time before they dropped the bomb, and to open the windows and the doors, because they'd break the windows or rattle your house, and everything would be like daylight, and then that would pass. But then in some of the information that was released, they said that the fallout might be a great inconvenience. So I just kind of wondered, those are kind of the days that during that testing period.
Daryl Luce, in addition to watching the Boulder and later Hoover Dam, you witnessed three explosions in uniform.
Yes, that's correct. I was sent by the United States Army out to the test site from Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and we were sent primarily to test the atomic cannon. However, They were doing a lot of testing at the time. We were there for about 6 weeks, and we witnessed two other tests while I was there. And, of course, I was about roughly 18 miles away from ground zero, and we had to turn around and cover our eyes while the initial explosion took place. But then you turn around and watch the fireball and the mushroom cloud. I might say, too, though, that on one of these tests, just 2 days later, we were volunteers, but we got in the bus, and they had, of course, checked out the target area with the radioactive safety engineers had been through the area, and we were taken down within 2 miles of ground zero to observe the damage that had been done. In those days, they, in the target area, they would put all sorts of military equipment, buildings, and things of that order. So I felt that the scientists had reduced the residual radioactivity considerably. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been down there 2 miles away from ground zero.
Darryl, I thought the first rule of Army life was that you learn never to volunteer for anything.
Well, I was a gung-ho young second lieutenant, and I was, as I said, yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
But I also have pictures showing them sweeping the dust off of you with a broom. So I thought you're a brave person.
Well, just before we formally switch to the subject of atomic testing, let me remind you that there are some stories, other stories that we're following here today at NPR News, and here are some of the headlines. Senator George Voinovich has agreed to send John Bolton's nomination to be UN ambassador to the Senate floor, where he said he would vote against him. The Ohio Republican said he'll join Democrats in voting against Bolton in committee. And virtually every GOP member since 1989 has taken money from Tom DeLay. This is making it hard for the Republican leadership to find a lawmaker for the Ethics Committee to judge his case. And you can hear details on those stories later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.